Hello, and welcome to this week's reading from The Economist magazine. The Economist has been published since September 1843. To take part in a severe contest between intelligence, which presses forward, and an unworthy, timid ignorance obstructing our progress. I'm Virginia Voice volunteer, Sheila Teague, reading recent articles from economist.com. Our first article, dated April 19th, 2024, from the graphic details section, titled, Abortion Politics. After Dobbs, Americans are turning to permanent contraception. More young women are tying their tubes. On June 24, 2022, America's Supreme Court ruled in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization to let states set their own laws on abortion. Since then, 14 have banned abortion completely, with exceptions for extreme circumstances. The consequences of overturning Roe v. Wade are becoming clearer. A stark one is the sharp rise in permanent contraceptive procedures among both men through vasectomies and women through tubal ligations. In a paper published on April 12th in JAMA Health Forum, a medical journal, researchers from the University of Pittsburgh and Boston University analyzed data on permanent contraceptive procedures among 18 to 30-year-olds. They looked at 22 million instances of patients attending at least one appointment for either evaluation or treatment. In each month between January 2019 and September 2023, these were mostly at academic medical centers, so government-funded public clinics providing free family planning services to poor people may not have been adequately represented. The results are nonetheless striking. The JAMA study found a sharp jump in permanent contraceptive procedures among both men and women in the months after the Dobbs decision. Before Dobbs, there were around 250 tubal ligations for every 100,000 women with health care appointments per month. But immediately afterwards, that number jumped by 58. In the following months, the growth rate accelerated from its baseline of 2.8 additional procedures per month in the 3.5 years leading up to Dobbs to more than 5. Men underwent fewer contraceptive procedures to begin with. Just before the Dobbs ruling, the study finds there were around 50 vasectomies per 100,000 male outpatients per month. This rate had been steadily increasing by about one procedure per month. In the month right after Dobbs, however, it jumped by 27, before reverting to its previous growth rate. What to make of these numbers? Those who had already been planning to undergo the procedure may have expedited their decisions. Some may have also feared a broader crackdown on other forms of contraception. Groups advocating the right to abortion have warned that bans from the moment of conception could be interpreted to include the morning after pill and intrauterine devices. That would suggest that permanent contraception, rather than a temporary method, is becoming more prevalent among young people. But that carries greater risk of so-called sterilization regret. A global review of studies in 2005 found that women who had tubal ligations at 30 or younger were 8 times more likely to undergo a reversal or an evaluation for in vitro fertilization than those who had the procedure later in life. A more recent paper in 2022, focusing on America, found that 13% of surveyed women who had their tubes tied at 30 or younger regretted their decision, compared with 7% of women who were over 30 at the time of the procedure. The decisions that Dobbs is forcing on young Americans may affect their lives in ways that were not widely anticipated. That article was titled Abortion Politics. After Dobbs, Americans are turning to permanent contraception. More young women are tying their tubes. Our next article, dated April 15, 2024. From the By Invitation section, titled Casualties of War. A trauma surgeon on why Gaza is the worst of war zones. It is like stepping back into the 19th century, says David Knott. Over the past 30 years, I have worked in war zones around the world as a surgeon treating casualties resulting from conflict, including in Syria, Yemen, Afghanistan, and Iraq. War wounds, the effects of fragments from blast injuries and gunshot wounds, require a special set of skills to manage. At times, there are mass casualties, and some of the patients I have seen over more than 30 war missions had overwhelming injuries that even the best units in the world would struggle to treat. The majority of injuries, though, could be dealt with using the resources at hand. Most patients at least had a good chance of arriving at a hospital within a time frame that allowed them to have the best surgical decision making. Gaza, however, is like no war zone I have ever witnessed. During my recent month-long mission to Rafah, the approach to the city, which is at the southern end of the Gaza Strip, was marked by mile after mile of stationary trucks carrying aid, which didn't appear to be going anywhere. The drive from Rafah through to the beach road, where most of the NGOs were staying, was a shock to behold. I have worked in refugee camps in Syria and Bangladesh, where orderly tented structures had been placed a safe distance apart. But here I witnessed thousands upon thousands of people massed in a small area. There were whole families with just a polythene sheet over their heads. the more fortunate had a tent, but those might hold 6 or 7 people, including children, with hardly any room to sit, never mind sleep, and with no toilet facilities. It felt inhumane. This went on for miles, with small clearings which were full of stinking and rotting rubbish, infested with flies and surrounded by children. My mission in Gaza was not to work as a surgeon on the front line, dealing with the effects of gunshot wounds and fragments from blast injuries, but to be on the second line, dealing with the surgical complications of thousands of patients. It was worse than I could have imagined. I worked in the only functioning hospital in Rafah. It had around 40 beds and 2 operating theaters. But by the time I arrived, there were already over 2,000 patients laying in the wards, in corridors, and in any other space that was not occupied. There were often 6 to 8 patients in a side room meant just for one. Many patients had had operations, and their risk of cross-infection, because of the proximity to each other, was enormous. Many had wounds that had been stitched but fallen apart, dressed with sodden gauzes stinking of pus and bacteria. All were malnourished, further weakening their immunity and the normal healing process. There was a total breakdown of the usual medical care that a society would give to its population, each in the midst of vicious wars, such as in Yemen or Syria. People had access to basic life-saving medicines. Not so in Gaza. All pharmacies had closed down, and there were no drugs. As a result, there was no access to daily medications for people with chronic illnesses such as diabetes, and those with cardiological, renal, oncological, and hematological diseases. Of the 12 renal dialysis machines that were available in our hospital, 10 had broken down, and the other 2 could not cope with the 30-fold increase in patients requiring dialysis. There were no oral antibiotics available for common conditions like chest infections or other gastrointestinal illnesses. Before the war, the World Health Organization ran a mass casualty training program and allocated an area within the hospital for the red patients, who would be triaged into those requiring surgery immediately and those who could wait a while, and a separate area for the green patients, who were the walking wounded. But by the time I arrived at the hospital, this system had broken down, overwhelmed by the sheer number of ill and dying patients. The chaos I saw made a mockery of patient triage, or any sense of order. With no access to routine medical or surgical help, it appeared that the hundreds of thousands of people squeezed together were on their own. It was the grimmest of tests for Darwin's theory of survival of the fittest. The effects of communicable infectious diseases were cruelly apparent. Some children could not breathe owing to the effects of simple chest infections that had progressed and turned their lungs into pools of pus, known as empyema. For the first time in my life, I found myself clinically diagnosing this awful condition, something you would read about in a medical book in the 19th century in young children. Next to 1 6-year-old, I found 0.5 liter of pus in a drain bottle. I was operating on young people dying of ruptured appendix simply because they had not been diagnosed early enough or could not get to a hospital to see a doctor. I operated on patients with bowels that were obstructed owing to cancers that should never have progressed so far. Once removed, the cancerous bowels were simply thrown away. Patients weren't offered the vital pathological analysis that informs their continued treatment because there were no laboratories. The accident and emergency department were overrun, and there were patients lying on the floor and propped up against the wall. Many of them had such severe infections of their limbs that they required amputation. Some were due to the effect of diabetes being left untreated. Others from the effect of previous injury. Khan Yunis, a city north of Rafah, was at that time under bombardment, and many of the wounded had to be left for 12 hours or so before being brought in to us. The majority of them by that time were in a state where nothing could be done. They were dead by the morning. David Knott is a consultant surgeon at St. Mary's Hospital in London, where he specializes in vascular and trauma surgery. He is the co-founder of the David Knott Foundation, which trains surgeons in war zones. That article was titled Casualties of War, a trauma surgeon on why Gaza is the worst of war zones. It is like stepping back into the 19th century, says David Knott. Our next article, dated April 17, 2024, from the International section, titled War and Recruitment. Would you really die for your country? Military conscription is on the agenda in the rich world. Belly down in a muddy Dutch forest, Sabrina van den Goober fires blanks from a Colt 7C assault rifle. The third-year medical student is taking part in the DNJAR service year, a new program that lets young Dutch sign up for a year-long trial in the armed forces rather than the regular 4-year enlistment term. The program is a success, drawing 3 applicants for each spot, and the government plans to scale it up from 625 to 1,000 trainees per year. Yet it can hardly begin to solve the country's recruitment problems. The Dutch armed forces number 49,000, less than a fifth of their size during the Cold War, and one in 10 positions is vacant. Last year, regular enlistment yielded just 3,600 of a hoped-for 5,000 new soldiers. This is at a moment when, in the face of the largest war on the continent since 1945, many European countries actually want to expand their armed forces, not just maintain them. By 2030, Germany hopes to raise its troop strength from 182,000 to 203,000, and France from 240,000 to 275,000. Poland plans to go from 197,000 to 220,000 by the end of the year, and eventually to 300,000. The problem is that today's career-oriented, individualistic young people are reluctant to join up. And it is not just Europe that is struggling with recruitment. In and around the world's conflict hotspots, the question of how to get more people into uniform is vital. Some countries are reconsidering an old solution: mandatory military service for young people or young men, often for school leavers. Terminology varies. Conscription typically means compelling civilians to enlist in the armed forces, whereas military service often refers to a subset of that, ordering young people to do a stint in the forces. At the start of the 20th century, around 80% of countries had some form of conscription. By the mid-2010s, it was just under 40%. The practice reached its peak during the World Wars, and many countries continued to rely on it throughout the Cold War. Thereafter, the West's focus turned to high-tech counterinsurgency campaigns, such as those in Afghanistan and Iraq. Mass conscript armies were mostly replaced by smaller, professional volunteer forces. Since 1995, 13 members of the OECD, a club of mostly rich countries, have scrapped conscription. All but 8 of NATO's 32 members have done away with it. But authoritarian countries, such as Iran, North Korea, and Russia, have doubled down on their press-ganged armies. The most urgent discussion around mandatory military service and conscription is in countries that face a serious threat of war, or are already in one. Take Ukraine. More than 2 years on from Russia's invasion, thousands of men there are fleeing across the country's borders, or hiding to avoid being served enlistment papers. On April 2nd, a lack of troops meant Ukraine's government was forced to lower the minimum age of conscription from 27 to 25. Russia has thrown hundreds of thousands of forcibly mobilized men into the meat grinder of its war. In Israel, military duties are a central pillar of citizenship. After the October 7th attacks, some 300,000 Israelis left civilian life and rushed to join their units. Israel wants to lengthen male conscripts' service to 3 years. Young women currently serve for 24 months, and young men for 32. And to extend the call-up age for reservists to 45. At the same time, ultra-Orthodox Jews' exemption from service is the subject of a bitter political struggle. Meanwhile, in Asia, Taiwan is trying to prepare for a possible war with China as Sino-American tensions persist. Taiwan extended military service in 2022 from 4 months to a year, but the island still boasts just 169,000 active soldiers. China has around 2 million. South Korea, where military service has a brutish reputation, is trying to make it more appealing. Service has been shortened to 18 months. Wages are rising and sadistic drill sergeants have been pruned. The government also wants to hire more women. Men-only conscription has fueled male resentment and anti-feminist politics. In many places, recruiters for the armed forces are struggling in the face of shifting values. Young people have grown averse to fighting even in defensive wars. For decades, the World Values Survey, WVS, an academic research project, has been asking people around the world the same question. Would you be willing to fight for your country? In the survey's most recent round, between 2017 and 2022, just 36% of Dutch 16 to 29 years old said yes. Recruiters try to counter with the rhetoric values. The empathic slogan of Germany's armed forces, the Bundeswehr, is wir, dienen Deutschland, we serve Germany. They also run campaigns with influencers on TikTok and Instagram, but it does not seem to be enough to hit their targets. This is partly to be expected. As countries grow richer, their citizens tend to become less eager to sacrifice themselves for the nation. Herfried Munkeler, a German political scientist, called Western democracies post-heroic societies, in which the highest value is the preservation of human life and personal well-being. History certainly plays a role. Willingness to fight is low in the countries that lost the Second World War, Germany, Italy, and Japan. In Spain and Portugal, decades of military dictatorship left many citizens suspicious of the armed forces. But things can change when conflicts draw near. According to a forthcoming paper by Wolfgang Wagner and Alexander Schrog of the VU University in Amsterdam and Michael Onderko of the Erasmus University in Rotterdam, proximity to war makes citizens more willing to fight. In Europe, this helps explain why countries close to Russia are less dovish. Political alignment is a poor predictor of willingness to bear arms. The radical right is not so eager to fight, says Mr. Wagner, at least in Germany and the Netherlands. Last year, he and his colleagues commissioned a study in those countries which found that few people who planned to vote for either far-left or far-right parties were willing to fight for their country. Those who backed centrist parties, such as Germany's Social Democrats and Christian Democrats, were more prepared to do so. Besides changing values, military recruiters face an economic hurdle. Young people currently have lots of employers bidding for their services. In most wealthy countries, Generation Z has its pick of jobs. Unemployment among 15 to 24-year-olds in the European Union was 14.5% last year, down from 22.4% in 2015. In Germany, it was just 5.8%. In such tight labor markets, armies have a hard time competing with the private sector. Besides, sitting at a desk is rather nicer than crawling through mud. In some wealthy countries, however, young people's willingness to fight remains high. In France, the share is 58% in the WVS. The figure is higher still in Singapore, Taiwan, and South Korea. In Denmark, Finland, Norway, and Sweden, four of the wealthiest and most peaceful countries in the world, two-thirds or more of citizens say they are willing. All are close to Russia. Their expanding armed forces also have no trouble finding soldiers. All four have compulsory military service for young people. Sweden actually eliminated the practice in 2011, but brought it back in 2018 after failing to meet recruiting targets. It is an intriguing case study for others. Having just joined NATO, it is scaling up from 69,700 to 96,300 soldiers, which requires about 10,000 recruits a year. All of the country's 19-year-olds, men and women, must fill out service questionnaires. A bit under a third qualify, and a tenth are ultimately inducted. Rather than souring young people on the armed forces, in Sweden, mandatory service seems to make them more enthusiastic. In exit surveys at the end of their stints, about 80% of the conscripts would recommend other young people to do military service, says Paul Johnson, the defense minister. Some 30% re-enlist as soldiers or reserves. Because more young people qualify than are needed, only the best candidates make it in, and military service looks good on one's CV. This kind of conscription helps keep Nordic armies a melting pot for different classes and discourages political polarization. Volunteers in armed forces tend to skew towards the right. In Germany, neo-Nazi cells have been uncovered in the Bundeswehr. In the Middle East, too, many states see military service for young people as a social adhesive. The United Arab Emirates introduced it in 2014. Partly to forge a sense of shared identity among its youth. Morocco, Jordan, and Kuwait have followed suit. You got no time to lose. Shortfalls across many Democratic states suggest that better recruitment strategies can do only so much to boost troop numbers. Few medical students have Miss Van den Gerber drive to take up infantry training on the side. In liberal societies, large segments of the population have come to see serving in the army as someone else's job. Reintroducing obligatory military service for youngsters might be politically and practically unworkable for the same reason recruitment is falling short. Citizens feel alienated from the armed forces. Yet the Nordic model seems to help bridge that gap, ensuring that military service remains a natural part of social life, and nudging more school leavers to consider a related career. Other youngsters may still only join up in a crisis. It is fear that moves you to action, says Andrea, a former television producer now fighting in eastern Ukraine. He signed up the day after Russia invaded. Most Ukrainians did not believe they would ever have to fight for their country either. That article was titled, War and Recruitment. Would you really die for your country? Military conscription is on the agenda in the rich world. Our next article, dated April 17, 2024, from the United States section, titled, Busted Truth. America's trust in its institutions has collapsed. What are the consequences? As far as stereotypes go, brash national self-confidence has long been a defining feature of how Americans are viewed abroad. In 2006, when Gallup first started asking Americans about their trust in key institutions, the country ranked at the top of the G7 league table, tied with Britain. In 2023, for the first time, America came last. New data from Gallup, a pollster, show that American trust in several national institutions is on the decline. That may not be surprising, given the fraught state of the country's politics, but the cumulative fall over the years is startling. 20 years ago, Americans had the highest confidence in their national government of people in any G7 country. Today, they have the lowest. Americans are tied with Italians in having the lowest trust in their judicial system, and came last in faith in honest elections. Even the army is suffering from a dip. Although still high at 81%, American trust in its armed forces is now lower than at any point since 2006. And gasp, lower than in France. The reasons behind this crisis of confidence is the self-declared greatest country on earth are varied. The roots of a healthy skepticism of government can be traced back to the Vietnam War and Watergate scandal of the early 1970s. The gradual dying out of the Second World War generation, which had significantly higher institutional trust than later generations, also plays a role. However, more recent developments help explain the sharp decline of the past years. Donald Trump's constant barrage of unfounded accusations about the 2020 presidential election clearly plays a big role in Americans' low trust in the electoral system, says Henry Brady of the University of California, Berkeley. This no doubt also contributes to growing distrust of the judiciary. Just last week, Mr. Trump called the criminal hush money trial against him a communist show trial. But few things seem to have done more to directly erode trust in the judiciary than the Supreme Court's decision in 2022 to overturn Roe v. Wade. Before this ruling removing a constitutional right to abortion in America, Democrats and Republicans trusted the court in roughly equal measure. Afterwards, confidence among Democrats dropped through the floor. The divergence with Britain is especially striking. Whereas British confidence in the country's judiciary and electoral system is higher than at any point in the history of the survey, America has moved in the opposite direction. Some 70% of Britons now say that they have confidence in the honesty of elections, compared with only 44% of Americans. Like America, the UK has seen a pretty steady decline in confidence in national government, observes Benedict Vickers from Gallup. But this more core belief in the foundation of the democratic system and in fair elections is still pretty strong. The same cannot now be said about America. Even within the broader OECD club of mostly rich democracies, only Hungary, Turkey, and Colombia have less trust in their honest elections. Yet more than the loss of trust overall, what really worries Mr. Brady is the increased polarization of trust in America. Having some institutions that Democrats trust more, journalism, higher education, science, and others that Republicans trust more, religion, the armed forces, and the police, is a matter of concern, particularly for the institutions themselves. The problem is even starker when the workforces of such institutions become increasingly homogeneous, something that has happened in predominantly progressive higher education, as well as in the predominantly conservative military services. Strong and credible institutions count among the best guarantors of a country's long-term stability. People who broadly trust authority are more likely to comply with government directives, such as filing their tax returns. During the pandemic, people who had high trust in government were more likely to get vaccinated and comply with public health guidance on lockdowns or social distancing rules. According to a meta-analysis by Daniel Devine of the University of Southampton and colleagues, blind trust in authority is dangerous, and a degree of skepticism can be healthy. But America's slide towards becoming an ever more distrusting place has perils of its own. That article was titled, Busted trust. America's trust in its institutions has collapsed. What are the consequences? In the final moments of the program, I will be reading from The World in Brief, catching you up quickly on the global stories that matter. Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, welcomed an American aid package worth $61 billion for his country, which was passed by the House of Representatives. He urged lawmakers to pass the bill into law as quickly as possible, arguing that it would prevent Ukraine becoming a second Afghanistan. Democratic lawmakers backed the plan, worth a total of $95 billion, put forward by Mike Johnson, the Republican House Speaker, overcoming hard-line Republican opposition. Mr. Johnson's defiance of some in his own party has endangered his own position. But he insisted he had done what he believed to be the right thing. Authorities in India announced a rerun of voting for the general election at 11 polling stations in the northeastern state of Manipur on Monday. There had been reports of clashes between armed groups, damaged voting machines, and attempts to take over polling stations. The leading opposition Congress Party alleged voting was rigged. The first stage of voting that will involve nearly 1 billion people began on Friday. It will run until June. Ecuadorians started voting in a referendum to give the government more powers to fight drug gangs and violent crime. The murder rate has leapt from 7 per 100,000 in 2019 to perhaps 45 now. 5 proposals would alter the Constitution if passed. One of them is to allow the army to routinely join police patrols rather than just under emergency decrees. South Korea expressed deep disappointment after Japanese ministers sent ritual offerings to Tokyo's Yasukuni Shrine, which includes 14 wartime leaders convicted of war crimes. Both South Korea and China view the shrine and such offerings as symbols of Japan's historic militarism and aggression. South Korea urged Japan to show repentance instead. The two had deepened ties recently in response to the perceived threat from China. That was The World in Brief, catching you up quickly on the global stories that matter. That's all the time we have for The Economist this week. This program is on the air every Wednesday evening at 6 p.m., with a rebroadcast the following Tuesday morning at 5 a.m. And you can listen anytime on demand at www.virginiavoice.org. Thank you for your time. I'm Sheila Teague for the Virginia Voice.